And a happy new year.
All right, that's it. No more beer for any of you. Entertainment industry is a $700+ billion a year business in the United States alone, or somewhere in that neighborhood, depending on who you talk to, because of the economy, obviously, and Los Angeles is the creative capital. For the past 13 years, we've brought you interesting and informative guests who are among the industry's movers, shakers, and decision makers in a weekly, unprecedented, unvarnished look into the behind the scenes of the record, film, and television industries, as well as the broader scope of the body politics on how things really work in aggregate in the entertainment business, and with respect to the political season, how the shifting, prevailing, and sometimes howling winds of Washington politics affect all of us in the entertainment industry. And I suspect that we're going to see some of that in the coming years. Good afternoon and welcome to Sam Brown's For the Record. I'm Sam Brown, your host on this one-of-a-kind world internet-wide radio talk show. This afternoon is the last show of 2008, and we've got yet another fantastic show for you, because we're more than just talk. And we welcome you every Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. right here, live from our Studio B. Our co-hosts have the afternoon off. They're spending it, of course, with their family this holiday weekend, and as I've been saying for the last 3 weeks, or two weeks, I'm here, and I'm here live, because I'm the boss, and as I've said, it costs to be boss, and I treat everybody as good or better than I would like to have myself treated in similar circumstances, so they get the time off. Sean Novak and Carlton Murray are here holding the fort, keeping an eye on me and making sure everything goes well. All right, so let me ask this rhetorical question, which really is not a rhetorical question. Actually, why so much music you hear sucks is the subtitle to the book Dirty Little Secrets of the Record Business by Hank Bordowitz. Now, we've been talking in our promoing about having Hank on, but he's on the East Coast where he lives. And I read the book quite a while ago, and I had to go through it again last night just to get up on some of the things Hank was talking about. And it's easy to say, I suppose, as the late Dr. Hunter S. Thompson said, that, quote, and I love this saying of Hunter Thompson's, the music business is a cruel money trench, a long plastic hallway where thieves and pimps run free and good men and women, he didn't put the women in there, I did, good men and women die like dogs. There's also a negative side. Unquote. But Thompson never did offer a solution. Author Hank Bordowitz does offer one in his book, Dirty Little Secrets of the Record Business, Why So Much Music You Hear Sucks. And though Bordowitz talks about the, quote, greed, stagnation, and short-sightedness that has left the multi-billion-dollar music business ailing and listeners' ears hungry for something better, unquote, he also says that there is, quote, more music available, more good music available than ever before, unquote. I agree with that. But it's just harder to find. That's our show for the day. The wise and the bad and the ugly and the where to find the good music. The book, Dirty Little Secrets of the Record Business. And we will be right back. By the by, Dave Bandt, if you're waiting to hear Dave, Dave is gone for the holidays. He'll be back next week as well. So we'll begin with our program right after this.
You are listening to Sam Brown's For the Record on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and 98.7 FM Santa Barbara. Join us Wednesday afternoon for a series explaining the lives of farm workers in California from statehood to the present. That's Pastors of Plenty Wednesday at 2.
I was trolling the internet as I do every day, looking for updates for this story that we're doing today. And on the 17th of December, I ran into this article on Hypebot called Four Dirty Little Secrets of Music 2.0. And I'm just going to go through these four things, and then we're going to jump into Hank Bordowitz's book. But this is what that – it's short, and it's a short article, so don't worry about it. The first dirty little secret of music 2.0, and I suppose it's internet, is big checkbooks still trump big ideas. Just ask any startup. You'd think that the major labels would embrace every great idea they could find to help save the struggling business. Nope. Labels are inundated with so many great ideas and are so desperate to help their bottom lines that the only ideas they take seriously are attached to fat checkbooks. Number two, every time music is licensed to an ad-supported music 2.0 service, they're probably breaking a contract. How many record label or publishing contracts do you know that say, quote, it's okay to pay me a tiny fraction of projected ad revenue every time my song is played or downloaded, unquote. Number three, you can't do it yourself. You can't do it yourself. There are not enough hours in the day to return emails from all of your Facebook friends, update your dates on eventful post, and Eventful is a website, by the by, for those of you who don't know. Post new photos on Flickr. Edit the expletives out of that backstage video before posting it on YouTube, and still find the time to write songs, record them, and then play them live. I would say you should also rehearse and then play them live. I would add that in there. It takes a village to raise a child. It takes a team to build a career. Start building one today. And number four, even after the FCC banned payola, indies still have no chance at radio. Little has changed. Indie music still has almost no chance of making it onto commercial radio. Radio programmers are too often sheep, playing fewer and fewer new records, and the vast majority still come from their pals at the major labels. And with that being the fourth, we're going to turn to Hank Bordowitz, who's online, And
okay.
And Tucker, how are you, Hank? Let me just give you your introduction and your props. Hank is a veteran music journalist, former recording artist, so he knows he's been on that side of the glass, music business consultant, adjunct professor of the music business, and the author of 7 critically hailed books, including Bad Moon Rising, The Unauthorized History of Creedence Clearwater Revival, Every Little Thing Gonna Be All Right, The Bob Marley Reader, Turning Points of Rock and Roll, and Billy Joel, The Life and Times of an Angry Young Man. Good afternoon, Hank. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm great. How's everything out in L.A.?
Everything in L.A. is doing well, thank you. The appearance is well, but that is the operative word, of course, is appearance.
Well, and as we all know, perception is everything.
Exactly. I've always said, one of my sayings for almost 30 years has been, money doesn't make the world go round. It's the perception of having it that makes the world go round. And we're seeing that in the crisis, that there are people that looked like they had money that obviously didn't, and some who did have a great deal who don't have a great deal anymore. So it's always the perception.
Yes, indeed.
Let me ask you about I just read from an article called 4 Dirty Little Secrets of Music 2.0 on Hyperbot. Hypebot. And the last one, because you talk about this, there's a couple of chapters about payola. And they say indies still have no chance at radio. Why is that so?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that, really. First off, it's important to realize that radio doesn't matter as much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Radio is just not as important as it once was, because, as you said, as it said in the article, they're reducing playlists. Playlists are getting thinner and thinner, and the kind of music that's getting played is being more and more mainstream. So it's not a way that people, I don't know, I'm an old guy, so you know, I remember I would listen to the radio to discover new music.
Mm-hmm.
And my children don't have that ability, don't have that luxury, because really new music is played on radio.
Right.
It's all the same old stuff. So, you know, we have to go elsewhere to discover new music.
But
the converse of that. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry?
No, I was going to say, let me just interject there. When you say the same old stuff, most of the people who use that expression, including me, are over the age of 30. When you listen to the conversations of 12-year-olds and you know, 15-year-olds and 18-year-olds, they don't usually use that expression, the same old stuff. That's because the same old stuff is new to them.
I don't know how true that is anymore. I mean, I've been teaching college for about 10 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I am amazed. One of the first questions I asked, I'm a great writer. Wonderful use of the English language there. One of the first things I ask my students is, what radio station do you listen to, if indeed you still listen to radio? And a lot of them do not listen to radio anymore.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them have just given up on radio. And those that do, about 50% of them, listen to the classic rock station.
Right. It's one of the most...
music you and I were listening to when we were their age.
Right. And you gave us a breakdown, I'm looking for it, of the most prominent genres of music, and I do believe I saw classic rock as leading the pack there.
It's way up there.
Yeah.
You know, it's so... I was pretty amazed by that until I found the two things that I used to, in fact, verify that, and with the information I put in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So, I have a 15-year-old niece and a 13-year-old niece, and, you know, when I ask them what they listen to, it's often, well, the 15-year-old is now into her classic rock phase, and the 13-year-old is saying, well, you know, I'm feeling a little too old for Hannah Montana and Britney Spears now.
Right.
And so I'm trying to find something new, and I'm not really finding it on the radio. So, you know, it's radio is digging a hole for itself right now. But then again, a lot of businesses are doing that.
Right, and I was talking to a friend of mine at dinner a couple of weeks ago, and I was saying, how long do you think it's going to be before the record industry goes to Congress looking for a bailout? We were musing, and I suppose there are some people in the powers that be that are considering that. Let me ask you this. I'm going to quote something that you wrote here. The stakes have become so high, the stockholders so demanding that there's no longer time to develop artists, cultivate sounds, or even create trends. It has all become very reactive. Between this and the regular personnel bloodbaths used to keep the bottom line down, the glamour of A&R has waned considerably. So being able to, you know, you combine that with the fact that there are probably 100 times more music and artists trying to get in than there were 20 years ago because of the easy accessibility it is to make a CD. A&R people do not have the time to go through all of that material.
Oh, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not very friendly with a lot of A&R people. And, you know, that's one of their big complaints is, you know, they're as frustrated trying to find new music as we are. And then they have the added frustration of trying to sell it to their corporate masters.
Exactly.
Who don't want to hear it.
And you made reference to a meeting with Polly Anthony walking in and making a remark about, and don't sign any more acts like Moe, M-O-E. Oh. Right. Do you remember that?
Yep. In fact, my buddy Mike Kaplan is still angry at me about that because I insinuated that his records don't sell, which is absolutely wrong. They do sell very well. It's just, you know, 95% of the records released don't sell. So, you know, that was more to what I was alluding.
And I've been saying that figure for years, that 90, 95, 90, I had it up as high as 97% of records don't sell, and meaning that they don't even break even, and that includes independents.
Well, I mean, I quoted this thing, Ed Kreisman up at Billboard every year, around this, coming up in a few weeks, in fact, does this thing where he goes through the SoundScan numbers and says, okay, last year, and by the way, you were correct that there are a lot more records being released. About 10 years ago, even, there was only 30,000 records a year being released. Now it's up to almost 70,000. In fact,
right. You're right.
So, yeah, you are correct about that, and it's very hard, you know, to gatekeep that. But what Ed did is he went through the figures and he said, well, you know, this many recordings sold over a million. This many recordings. And he came up to the figure, like, one thing he came up with is 50% of all record sales come from 0.2. That's 0.2% of the recordings released commercially.
Right.
So that's like 120 recordings supporting the entire business.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty scary thing. I mean, how many other businesses can say that about their products?
Right.
That 120 products are supporting the entire industry.
You know, I used to say that all the time, years, because that's pretty much been it. I would say, how many industries do you know are going to sustain themselves with a batting average below 100? And today, and you pointed out in your book, I suspect it's even more, you say, and I'm quoting here, many of the majors will not sign artists who have not previously sold 20,000 units of a record, either via an independent record company or on their own.
That is, and that figure has probably gotten higher, and there are other things. They have to have a story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to have something, some unique selling point. And what I'm thinking these days is, once you get to that point, if you do the math, what do you really need the major labels for?
Mm-hmm. And I've heard that. Most people will tell you that are seeking major label deals is that what they want is global promotion. They want to be able to tour the world to know they're out there, and leapfrog, literally leapfrog over all of the independent artists that just slam their stuff on the net and hope and pray and cross their fingers that somebody will discover them. And they...
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, they feel that with a major deal, if they do the record right and they come up with a hit or two, that's real. They could run with that for a couple of dozen years or so.
That's absolutely right. Also, the problem there being that only, you know, again, you know, 1 or 2% of the musicians out there can do that, whereas, you know, this is a unique time to find an audience if you know how to build it.
Right.
And the tools are out there now. Tools, I mean, I'm not just talking about Facebook or, you know, MySpace, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just here in a car with my wife.
I heard your wife.
Technology, yes, MySpace.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot more to it than that. And a clever manager can take care of that. And what I'm seeing in the future, one of the potential futures of the music business, and the music business has several, but of the recorded content business, is that managers are going to become the people who are going to be them and making the deals internationally, and the aggregators are going to be, you know, help, you know, eventually starting to really, you know, dig into the products that they aggregate and saying, well, this is, we're seeing some action on this. Why? And when they figure out why, trying to build that and figure out how to do more. So, you know, there's it's a brave new world out there right now. It's a very exciting time, really, to be in the music business.
One of the things about your book that I really liked, and I will tell you in a minute, the one thing I had, and it's a personal thing of mine, as one of the reasons, although you did give... You did genuflect towards it. But you talk about something that I think is extremely important, because I think we've gotten so far down the line where musicians and artists think that if you do music, if you're a musician and you want to be an artist, that you should just do the art and don't worry about making any money. And I think that's bull. I think that it's a profession. I think it all the things that go into any other profession, you wouldn't want to go to a doctor or a surgeon who never went to medical school. And the more I hear, the more I'm able to tell that so many musicians and artists today have no musical education. But we'll get to that. I want to talk about what you, and I'm going to quote you from the book here, where, because I did not know this, but you said, the Bible refers to musicians playing in the courts of King David and Solomon, and one would imagine that such performers would get paid. A millennium after that, the Greek theater used music and paid the musicians who played there. So music became a profession sometime before the Common Era. That's at least 2,500 and probably more like 4,000 years of professional music. So musicians need to get paid. Is that not correct, Hank?
Musicians
and artists. And artists.
And they do get paid. And, you know, they don't get paid nearly enough. They don't get paid what they're worth, certainly. Nor do writers, by the way. Nor do college professors. But, you know, they do get paid.
And policemen and firemen would say they don't get paid either, as well as they should be. Why do you think...
And I agree with that, by the way.
Why do you think that songwriters, and now comes my own personal thing, because I am a songwriter, fortunately, I've done very well. Thank you very much. But why do songwriters, and as long as I've been in this business, they've always been the bottom of the food chain and the least respected, and yet without them, there are no songs to sing, and without songs to sing, everything goes away. And why is that?
Well, I call this book Dirty Little Secrets of the Record Business, because that's another secret. It's not a dirty one either. It's one of my favorites, though, especially when I'm teaching students.
Right.
As a songwriter, you may be, again, perceived as being on the bottom of the food chain. But you know, and I know, that if you have a hit song, that keeps on giving. Because publishing has been, since the days of Gutenberg, publishing has been where the money's at in the music business.
If you have a hit song, you got to repeat that caveat, because everybody thinks that if you own the copyright or publishing, which is one and the same, of a song, you're going to get wealthy. But not if you're a part of the 95% of records who sell CDs, who sells less than 10,000 copies on a single, on their first run, which most of them do.
Well, unless, of course, you're very canny about how you promote your songs. I know an artist, for example, who, you know, is a self-funded artist, and her records are made at the, permission of her fans. Her fans send a certain amount of money before she records an album, because she has recorded several albums, and they've all been consistently good and consistently what they want to hear. But
right.
She also manages to get her songs on television shows.
Right. You mentioned her in the book as well.
Right. So, yeah, so Jenny does that, and she does a very wonderful job at it.
But I'm talking about the tens of thousands of artists and musicians and songwriters who are out there who don't get paid. I mean, you also mentioned something, and I'm trying to remember what the context was, about artists like Bo Diddley, and you mentioned something about another artist that you said they had a hit record, and the guy said, and we're back to flipping burgers. I think there was a whole chapter on that.
Oh, yeah. That was a bunch of rap artists, and that was not even specific artists. That was a
veritable plethora of rap artists.
That's why this guy left his A&R position. He left this, gig that was paying him, $250,000 a year, because he just couldn't stand what was happening to his artists anymore. And that's a lack of education. That's one of the reasons I like, for the past 10 years, I've been teaching the music business and music at schools. That's one of the reasons I do it, is because, partly is to avoid people being ripped off.
Right.
The business will still do that to you if you let it, and there's no excuse for letting it anymore, because this information is now freely available, whereas when Bo Diddley signed with Chess and Arc Music and they took all his publishing, it wasn't. When John Fogerty signed with Fantasy and part of his contract, one paragraph in there said, all of your publishing up to this point belongs to us.
Right.
They showed it to a lawyer. Happened to Sue Cook's father was a lawyer, and as close a thing back in those days as there was to an entertainment lawyer. He worked for the Oakland Raiders for one of his clients. So he understood entertainment contracts, and, he looked at it and said, yes, it's a contract, and they signed it. And it was, I sent this contract, and I got it to my lawyer, and I said, is this really as bad as I think it is?
Mm-hmm.
My lawyer came back with, yes, this is the Stephen King novel of recording contracts.
Right.
I read it, and the small hairs stood up on the back of my neck.
Right.
And
you make a point of telling us that most recording contracts have some kind of clause in them that literally tells you or asks you or demands that you usurp your constitutional rights. Most people don't know that copyright and intellectual property is in the Constitution, Article 1. And says, give me your copyrights. Yet they, in the business, copyrights are known as property, literally property, like real estate. And I ask, the classes that I teach and my students, would you give away property? Just here. You want it here.
Yeah, it's why intellectual property has become a big buzzword now. So hopefully down the road, people are going to start getting wiser to this. And I think people are getting wiser to this.
Well,
Also, they want this so bad.
Yeah, the people doing that know that.
Right. So, what are you willing to give up for it?
Right.
And, we could go so many ways with this conversation right now.
Well, I've always said that, if the song is really, if people really believe that song is a hit, you can negotiate. If they're just trying to build their own personal catalog, and you're a sucker, and you want it so bad, then, they'll be the first one to tell you, okay, walk away from the table. But they're not going to tell you that if what they think they have, is an unpolished diamond, a diamond with a little bit of mud on it, they're going to go, no, because you'll take it down the street, somebody will take half, and they're going to clean up. Okay, let's talk turkey.
And apart from everything else, and this goes back to something you were saying earlier, that's one of the reasons that an artist should have somebody with some business savvy in their corner, be it an attorney, be it a manager, be it a concerned parent who knows his way around the music business, or her way. Because, it's easy for somebody who doesn't know to get caught up in this.
All right,
it could be very ugly.
Well, especially if you have one hit, it could be ugly. All right. Hank Bordowitz is the author of the book Dirty Little Secrets of the Record Business, Why So Much Music You Hear Sucks. And when we come back, we're going to bring in Moses Avalon, who is on phone, and he'll join the conversation. And I want to begin by something else that I have often said, and I've gotten into this argument so many times where artists or managers say, well, the reason the song didn't happen was because the label didn't promote it or there was no promotion. That's the first place they go to blame. And I have said that all the money, all the payola in the world cannot make people go out and buy something they don't like because the song ain't there. And you talk about that in your book. We're going to talk about it a little bit right here when Hank Bordowitz, author of Dirty Little Secrets of the Record Business, comes back, and joining us will be Moses Avalon. I'm Sam Brown. You're listening to Sam Brown's For the Record. We'll be right back.
Greetings, I'm Chuck Foster. Join me today at 3 o'clock for Reggae Central, 2 hours of ska, rocksteady, dub, dancehall, and lots of roots and culture. That's Reggae Central today at 3 o'clock.
This is Ray Parker Jr. If it's something strange in your music career, who you gonna tune into? Sam Brown's For the Record on KPFK.
And we're back with Hank Bordowitz, who is author of Dirty Little Secrets of the Record Business, and Moses Avalon, is he on?
I'm here, Sam.
Mo, you're there. Where are you? In Barstow?
I'm here, Sam.
Huh?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Are you in Barstow?
Am I where?
Barstow.
No. I'm at the Marriott Desert Resort in Desert Hot Springs.
Oh, I thought you would be driving back by now. Okay.
Well, so did I, but you know how that works out when you have kids and family and all that other stuff.
And happy holidays, holy days to you as well. Have you been able to hear the conversation up to now?
I have not, so you have to fill me in a little bit.
Oh, okay. We're getting ready to talk about payola. I used to get into these arguments, and I know you and I have talked about it, not necessarily argued about it, but just talked about it, that all the promotion, a gazillion dollars worth of promotions cannot make a record a hit, which is something that most managers and artists blame when their record, their song doesn't happen, and it just doesn't happen. The first people that get blamed is the promotion part, department of the label and the indie promoters. And I'd like to just read something out of the book where Hank says, all the promotion in the world, all the payola in the world, and all the airplay in the world will not turn a terrible record that no one wants to hear into a hit. As Dick Clark said, and I'm quoting, you quoting Dick Clark, you can't make a record a hit by playing the hell out of it. Why isn't it that more people don't know that?
Are you asking me?
Yes.
Oh.
I'm asking both of you.
It's possible that when you say most people, I assume you're talking about the powers that be at record
yes.
companies who
yes.
allocate this money, right? Is that what you mean by nobody?
I'm saying everybody, from the powers that be to the artists themselves who think that all they have to do is get the right promotion, get enough money thrown up against their product, and it'll be a hit.
Well, here's the thing. In an extreme case, that's probably true. But the reality is, you know, terrible songs don't become hits.
No.
But you can't see, once you shift it over a little bit and say, well, what about a mediocre song or a slightly better than average song? Can you make that a hit by throwing tons of promotion at it? Then the equation starts to kind of fall apart. Because you can make a mediocre song a hit if you throw enough money at it. That might not be a hit for long, but I mean, I'm sure all of us here could sit here and quote songs that became huge hits that were, you know, the songs were okay. They weren't really that great, and the artist wasn't that great. So why'd they become a hit? They became a hit because someone threw a shitload of money at it.
Let's watch our language. I got to write that up.
Sorry.
I got to write you up. Okay.
It's like a turntable hit.
Right, and they used to call that.
Song that gets just played to death on the radio, and, you know, people hear it on the radio, and it may be, you know, so transparent that, you know, if you don't turn the radio off, which is all that matters to radio. Radio is not there to entertain you. Radio is there to sell advertising time and to keep you tuned in.
Right.
So if you're on the radio, if the song is not turning people off, if people are not, you know, turning their radio to another station when they hear this song, then for radio, that's good. And so you have songs that, you know, get played to death and people get their, you know, ASCAP and BMI money, but they don't sell a whole lot of records. Harry Fox isn't lighting up over them.
And I always said that, you know, you got your turntable hits, which are records that get a whole lot of spins because a lot of money is thrown at them and never sell anything. And then you have what I called back in the 80s during the disco era, disco or dance club hits, music that gets played all the time in the clubs and everybody jumps up and dances to them, but they don't run out of the club that night and they're standing in line in Walmarts to go buy it.
Nor could you probably get that record at Walmarts.
Well, I'm just using Walmart because I'm looking at Walmart in your book when you talk about pop music.
I
know. This is very, very true. But you know what I'm saying. It gets promoted in all the clubs, but nobody goes out and buys it. They just like to dance to it. So the labels think that because everybody's responding to it in the clubs, that it's a hit. It needs more money thrown at it. And it's really, you know, as Berry Gordy, who arguably built the most incredible stable of writers, maybe next to Don, or even in front of Don Kirshner, who had people like Carole King, Jerry Goffin, and those people, who used to say it's the song the song makes the artist and not the other way around, because the first thing you notice about the artist is their song, and you don't even know who the artist is. And that's why
I also noticed their voice and stuff. I mean, you know, that's also kind of fallacious.
Exactly. People don't really care. They don't even care about how old they are. What they care about is the song, because that's the part that emotionally grabs people, as they use the word hook, when they first hear it. And it's the song. It's totally the song. All right. Let's talk about the internet. Because you cover a lot of territory in this book, and I think it's fabulous, and I just want to say, you know, I read it a couple of years back, and I reread it last night to just, you know, refresh my memory on things, and I forgot how good of a read this is. So, you know, if you're in the record business, or actually in any entertainment business, I would highly recommend Dirty Little Secrets of the Record Business. Because the way you break it down is really very interesting, and there are things in here you're going to learn about. Talk about, Hank, and comment on it, Moses, the internet, and why is it that what we see as so far as sales is concerned on the internet mirrors what we were seeing with, you know, in retail stores?
Because it's easier?
My mirrors.
In other words, the amount of music sold on the internet is not any more, quote unquote, than the CDs that are being sold in retail. In fact, the internet, based on the numbers, has not taken over the amount of sales of music. As a matter of fact, I think the last survey I saw, it was something like 17%, maybe 13%.
Well, firstly, you have to qualify when you say internet sales. You're referring to downloads.
Downloads.
Okay, well, that's the difference, because Amazon sells a boatload of records, a boatload of CDs. So I think it's important that we differentiate in order to, you know, workshop your question here. You're talking about sales of downloads versus sales of physical products.
Right.
Okay.
Hank?
Yeah. I thought Moses was going to go on about that, which I would have loved to.
I didn't want to step on Hank's toes, and you know he's a big guest here. I'm just a
You're just a guy at the Marriott, sitting around in his underwear, saying, you know, turn it back to the Patriots.
far actually. And just, by the way, I gave myself a new car for Christmas, and I strongly advise anyone who's ever been interested in buying a BMW to get their butt down to any BMW dealership. They're basically giving them away, two for one.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting to know. Okay.
Maybe this bit of promotion will get the book to the point where I can do that. Let's see. The internet is still in its infancy. It still, you know, hasn't figured out what it wants to be when it grows up.
Mm-hmm.
The internet is, you know, people are predicting the death of the CD, and I don't see that happening anytime really, really soon.
Neither do I.
I've said it 100 times. I keep getting flack in my blog whenever I feel CDs are going to be around for a long, long time, and there's always some wackos that come out of the woodwork who say, yeah, what happened to 8-track tapes? I'm like, all right, well, clearly you do not understand what's going on if you compare CDs to 8-track tapes.
Right.
On the other hand, I just, because I'm going to be moving from Illinois, hopefully back to New York very soon, I just sold all of my CDs with the proviso that they digitize them, and I'm going to be getting a terabyte hard drive with all my music on it. So, you know, there's that too. But there are people who want that physical product in their hands, but there's also people who just want to be able to hear this song on their iPod or their MP3 player whenever they want to hear it.
Exactly.
So they'll be willing to either pay the 99 cents or deal with the P2P situation, which is gotten a lot more difficult over the last few years. I don't know. Melissa, have you noticed that?
Yeah, I actually follow this up pretty closely, and I agree with you. CDs are going to be around for a long time. Digital sales, much like cable TV, didn't kill the film industry or the television industry. Digital sales is going to be another avenue to sell products. Are we going to see a drop in CD sales? Well, of course. That's natural. There's a new medium out there, and everyone's excited about it, so people are purchasing off it. But purchasing music off the Internet is very expensive. 99 cents for a song, I think, is very expensive. And subscription services, I think, are very expensive. To pay $15 or $16 a month, you know, for all the music you can listen to, but none of the music you can own, starts to add up over time. So CDs are still the cheapest way to buy music, and because of that, they'll be, and for a lot of other technical reasons, they'll be around for a long time to come. But I think the dirty secret of the music business, which is our topic today, is that the music business in general is having a hard time. And I don't see it that way at all. I read the annual reports of every label and their parent companies and all the little investment banking companies that invest in these companies. The music business is doing just fine. CD sales are off, or dropped rather. But so what? CD sales are down 30% compared to 2002. But they're up compared to 1991. So when we talk about the music business going to hell in a handbasket, I'm not really sure what people are talking about. If you're not talking about CD sales, then you're not talking about anything, because digital is up, licensing is up, concerts are up, everything is up.
And Hank, you made a point of talking about the gloom and doomers who've been saying that since 1941, that the end is nigh for the record business.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, when you got to the Depression, just from a historical point, you go to the Depression and music sales go from like 112 million units to 5 million units during the 1930s. And then by 1941, with the beginning of the war, they're back up, you know, through the roof, 250 million units. And now right. We're talking in terms of 12 billion units.
I did an article on this recently where they talked about Black Friday and how music sales were very down because of Black Friday. The article, clearly a very tech-biased article, also in the same article mentioned that Xbox sales were through the roof. And the number one item that is bundled with Xbox is Rock Band. And Rock Band involves the licensing of, you know, several dozen top pop songs. So it's very skewed when you read about music sales down. You know, Black Friday was terrible for the music business. They're talking strictly about CD sales, and not even CD sales. They're talking strictly about new releases on major labels at top line prices. Oh, those are down. So what? Who cares?
That's true. Absolutely. And, you know, part of the thing with Rock Band, with, you know, the video games in general, I mean, you know, Grand Theft Auto, you play the radio in your car, and you can get, what is it, I think the latest one has 70-odd songs built into the game, and each of those gets paid, you know, a mechanical royalty every time the game gets pressed, every time a game gets sold. And so, you know, there are all sorts of outlets now for music that nobody dreamed of. You know, I mean, think about it. A century and a quarter ago, there were no recordings. Nobody knew what a recording sounded like. Nobody knew what music sounded like. You know, but even 10 years ago, nobody dreamed about, you know, 70 games, you know, collecting royalties on 70 games on a, you know, 70 songs on a video game.
And also, you're absolutely right. But also, you're talking, if you talk to people like Amoeba Records, they'll tell you that sales are up. So the only people who are experiencing music sales being down are new artists on RIA-affiliated labels being sold at top-line prices in major outlets. Those sales are down. All other sales are up.
All right, let's go to the phones. We've got people who are calling in. We have time to take one or two calls. The number 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. If you have a questions, I don't have time. We're running out of time. Don't have time for comments, but I do have time for some quick questions. 818-985-5735. Okay. let's talk about real quickly, Hank and Moses, about advertising or promotion on the internet. You can't just throw your CD up on the internet and expect people to find it, can you?
You can't just throw a CD into a store and expect people to find it. You've got to promote any product that's out there, because otherwise how is anyone going to know about it?
Exactly.
Of course, with music, you've got the thing that the live show is your best performance, you know, your best promotion. And it's interesting because that just feeds in a loop, because the show feeds the CD sales. CD sales feed the show, you know, people going to the show. So, you know, that's one of the great things historically about the music business.
Exactly.
We've got all these great things that build on each other.
Yeah, I agree. You can't, you know, it's no different than saying, well, I'm going to put a CD in a store and hope that people know where it is and go where to look for it, know where to find it and buy it. You have to do promotion on the internet. The double-edged sword of the internet is it is a lot easier and a lot cheaper to promote things on the internet than it is to promote things in the brick-and-mortar world. The double-edged sword of that, though, is you have to know how to do it. And investing the time and the effort and the money to figure out how to do it, that can set you back a little bit. But once you know how to do it, it pays off in spades.
And then you can do it for other artists as well. But, yeah, that's absolutely true. You've got to – I mean, I get maybe 80 emails a day from musicians. I mean, some of them are reaching me through their promotion companies or publicity companies. Some of them are reaching to me just by themselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you get on a mailing list, you'll get that. You know, artists just seek me out because they see the books, and I get a lot of that. But, you know, I'm sure that if they have a sign-up sheet at their shows, those same emails are going to their fans.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that, you know, which is why I wanted to just bring this in, is that you hear so many artists say, well, I can make music on the internet. And I say, okay, you get through with your CD and you know, you get your 1,000, 1,500 units coming in from Oasis or, you know, wherever. And now what are you going to do? Well, I'm just going to put it up on my website and people will find it because it's great. Not so.
Now, if there's more to it than build it and they will come.
Right.
You know, you've got to guide them there. And, you know, one of the next great frontier on the internet, as far as I'm concerned, is gatekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
You've got some early efforts at it. You've got some very successful ones. Pandora is something I'm very, very fond of in terms of it's the first place I've discovered music that I've been unaware of in a decade. You know, it's just, I put in a name, I put in something I like, and they give me just tons and tons of other stuff, and it's just brilliant.
That's similar.
It's, yeah, and it's brilliant.
It analyzes your taste and then finds other things that are similar. It's the way to go. It's brilliant.
And these guys, I mean, they did it. They found this nexus between science and art that's almost kind of scary, where they programmed in the elements of the song and the elements of the artist that, you know, for each song and each artist, and then they find stuff that has the similar algorithm, and if you don't like it, you say, I don't like this, and it starts doing the math about why you don't like this music, and it starts feeding you music that you will like.
Well,
and eventually, if you train it well enough, it just gives you all this music that you like.
Well, I've always been one that said science is art and art is science. Form is function and form is formula. I mean, no matter how you can't just not say, you know, people say to me oftentimes dealing with songs, well, what comes from the heart? And I say blood. Nothing more, nothing less. Don't believe the other stuff that you hear. Hank Bordowitz is the author of the book, Dirty Little Secrets of the Record Business. I recommend that you get it. Moses, what are you plugging this week? Your book, your workshop.
I guess the workshop. My workshop is now online, and anybody can visit it at confessionsworkshop.com.
Confessions.
With an ask, plural, confessions. Anybody can send me an email or get on my mailing list by just going to MosesAvalon.com. And the beginning of next year, there'll be the 10th anniversary edition of my first book, Confessions of a Record Producer, which will be coming out not just as a book, but as an iPod app.
Outstanding. And Hank, you got an email, website?
www.bordowitz.com.
Spell Bordowitz. Bordowitz, B-O-R.
B-O-R, that's true. B-O-R-D-O-W-I-T-Z.
Right. And again, the book is Dirty Little Secrets of the Record Business. Yeah, go ahead. We got to talk. You want to add a thought?
I lost it. It's gone. There's also musicwriter.biz.
Okay.
Another site I have.
Okay. We're going to have you back because there's so many delicious things in here, and I'd like to leave our audience with the thought that Bon Jovi, but not the artist Bon Jovi, wrote in the book, and he said, it's the song you're selling and the musicians who are playing it. That's what this business is all about. And that's one of the things that I've always said. And I wonder when the record companies are going to get it and start putting A&R people and producers and the people who select the music who know what a good song sounds like as opposed to good production. Because you can have great production on a terrible song, and it ain't going to sell. That's it for today's edition of Sam Brown's For the Record, and we thank all of you for joining us. If you'd like
thank
to hear this,
Sam.
Thank you, Hank. If you'd like to hear this show again, or you'd like to share it with a friend or listen to the previous editions of Sam Brown's For the Record, go to kpfk.org, click on Audio Archives. In the left menu, once you're there, you can listen online or get our podcast. Or you can email me if you have any thoughts, questions, comments, criticisms, complaints, or clarifications on this afternoon's program. And I'm at sbrown, kpfk, at aol.com. Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Carlton. Happy New Year, everyone. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Sam Brown's For the Record on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara. Join us Wednesday afternoon for a series exploring the lives of farm workers in California from statehood to the present. That's Pastures of Plenty Wednesday at 2. Your Sunday afternoon music block is coming up next. Starting things off is Reggae Central with Chuck Foster, so keep it tuned.
With the new car business down right now, you might think that we don't need your vehicle donation. However, the market for donated vehicles is very strong. Please donate your old car, truck, RV, or motorcycle to us at 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. Or online at kpfk.org. We'll take care of everything, and you'll help support the quality programming you hear on KPFK. Just call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. Or donate online at kpfk.org.
Looking for a place to rake your brains and shake your bones while visions of sugar plums dance in your head? Well, then let your vegetable presence stay right where it is and tune in to The Music Never Stops every Sunday night from 9 to 11 p.m. for weekly doses of Grateful Dead concert tapes, contemporary jam rock, local freakiness, and miscellaneous psychedelia designed to lubricate your mind. I'm your irresistibly charming host and imaginary friend, Barry Smolin, inviting you to light up a Sabbath candle or whatever it is you light up on a Sunday evening and partake of this hippie headspace, our little niche of bliss here in the nether sphere. That's The Music Never Stops, Sunday night at 9 on KPFK 90.7 FM, psychedelic radio for the universe and elsewhere.